morning to turn to 2 Kings chapter 6. I won't bore you with how I got to this passage, but over the last 2 months, we have had a whole variety of experiences, many new things, and I want to take some. Let's look at verse. I didn't even pick it out. Verse 15. Kind of going to be a text verse. We're going to look at this story and pull out a few principles for life after we discuss the story a little bit. But verse 15 is where we are going to get our title and the thrust of the message. Verse 15 of 2 Kings chapter 6. And when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth, behold, an host compassed the city, both with horses and chariots. And his servant said unto him, Alas, my master, how shall we do? And that's the title, How Shall We Do? A number of the songs, at least the last two for sure, spoke somewhat about the whole faith thing. Maybe we'll refer to them after a bit. I'd like to read this story, what pertains to the story that I want to look at, starting at verse 8, and we'll read through verse 23, and then look a little bit more in depth at the story. Starting at verse 8 of 2 Kings chapter 6. Then the king of Syria warred against Israel and took counsel with his servants, saying, In such a place shall be my camp. And the man of God sent unto the king of Israel, saying, Beware that thou pass not such a place, for thither the Syrians are come down. And the king of Israel sent to the place which the man of God told him and warned him of, and saved himself there not once nor twice. Therefore the heart of the king of Syria was sore troubled for this thing, and he called his servants and said unto them, Will ye not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? And none of his servants said. And one of his servants said, None, my lord, O king. But Elisha, the prophet that is in Israel, telleth the king of Israel the words that thou speakest in thy bedchamber. And he said, Go and spy where he is, that I may send and fetch him. And it was told him, saying, Behold, he is in Dothan. Therefore sent he thither horses and chariots and a great host. And they came by night and compassed the city about. And when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth, behold, an host compassed the city, both with horses and chariots. And his servant said unto him, Alas, my master, how shall we do? And he answered, Fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. And Elisha prayed and the Lord and said, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. And when they came down to him, Elisha prayed unto the Lord and said, Smite this people, I pray thee, with blindness. And he smote them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. And Elisha said unto them, This is not the way, neither is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom ye seek. But he led them to Samaria. And it came to pass, when they were come into Samaria, that Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men, that they may see. And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw. And behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. And the king of Israel said unto Elisha, when he saw them, My father, shall I smite them? Shall I smite them? And he answered, Thou shalt not smite them. Wouldest thou smite those whom thou hast taken captive with thy sword and with thy bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master. And he prepared a great provision for them, and when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. So the bands of Syria came no more into the land of Israel. And we'll stop there. And we'll look a little bit at these at this story before we go into some of the, I hope, practical areas in this story. So Jehoram was king here, and 2 Kings 3 says, Now Jehoram, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria, the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. Verse 2, And he wrought evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father and like his mother, for he put away the image of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he cleaved unto the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. He departed not therefrom. Jehoram was a wicked king. This was not a godly king. In fact, in between I believe, if I have it straight, in between Ahab and Jehoram was the man, I think it was Ahaziah, reigned for about 2 years. He was also a son of Ahab, and he was a wicked king, and he died a young age. Now, verses 8 and 9 tell us that the king of Syria, it says, the king of Syria warred against Israel. And he set about to go and get the king of Israel, Jehoram. Now, the king of Syria at this time, I believe, was Ben-Hadad. It tells us that later on if you go in the next chapter of 2 Kings. But Syria and Israel were battling against each other even back when Ahab was king. So prior years before this, there was a battle going on, and this was back and forth between them. If I understand right, Syria was on kind of the west side of the Sea of Galilee, if you know what the Palestine area looks like. And Samaria was kind of north of Jerusalem. It was part of the northern kingdom. But this was not just across town. Syria was on the other side of the Jordan River, and Samaria was on the west side of it. So we see here also in verse 9, I believe it is, that the man of God Elisha kept warning the king of Israel, Jehoram, the wicked king, mind you, that the king of Syria is waiting for you, and don't go this way, because he's going to get you. And putting in my own words, and it says here, I take from what it says here in verse 10, that he didn't escape just once or twice. This happened more than once or twice, that the king of Israel's life was spared because he listened to the man of God, Elisha. Now, verse 11, it says that the heart of the king of Syria was sore troubled. He was exceedingly troubled about this whole condition. I mean, how could this be that he could not get the king of Israel? He has tried numerous times and could not get him. Finally, he said, he suspicioned a traitor. He said to his servants, so which one of you, who of you is actually telling the king of Israel what we're doing here? In verse 12, apparently one of his servants knew better. He says, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet in Israel. Tell the king of Israel what happened. I don't know. I don't want to assume too much, but just a few chapters prior to this, we have Naaman, who was a captain of a Syrian army, got leprosy. And we know that story. And he came and was healed by Elisha's servant. He came to the land of Israel for healing. Could this have been Naaman here? I don't know if this was Naaman talking to the king of Syria or not, because, well, it says Naaman, if I understand the story right, he wanted to take dirt long back and to worship the God of Israel. So I don't know if this was Naaman, but this was not the first occasion that the Syrians had an acquaintance with Elisha. But his ability was made known here. The servant of the king of Syria, whoever he was, said, well, listen, king, you don't know who you're up against. This Elisha knows what you're saying in your bedchamber. He knows what you're speaking in private. He's able to know that, and he's able to pass the word along. So verses 13 and 14, he says, well, let's go get him. He says, go and spy where he is, because I want to go get him. And they said, well, he's in Dothan. Now, surprisingly, it appears like if the king of Syria would have used some of his rationale, he probably wouldn't have even done this. Because if he already knew that the king of Israel was spared because of the man of God, why did he not even think through that Elisha would know that he's coming to get him? I mean, if he knew his secrets and saved the king of Israel's life, I don't know what he expected to do by chasing after Elisha. But nonetheless, he did. He tried. So he sent thither horses and chariots and a great host, it says. He never stopped to think about that Elisha probably knew he was coming. Now let's talk a little bit about Dothan. Dothan, according to the Bible dictionary, was a small city that set up on kind of a knob. And the land sloped around this city, around this knob. We also know from verses later on that apparently there was mountains that were kind of surrounding this little hill, this little knob. But this city of Dothan was set up on this knob. Now, the city, the knob was about 10 acres and the sloping areas around was about 15 acres, which makes it approximately a 25-acre city. Now, when I think of cities, I never knew this until I was studying this yesterday or whatever it was, reading more about Dothan. This was a small city. We also know that it was fortified by a heavy wall. Archaeologists did some digging, I think, back in 35, and they determined that this city was heavily fortified by a wall. But just to get a picture of 25 acres, if you can, it's roughly a little over 1,000 foot square. If this city was square, a little over 1,000 feet square. And so, why would the king of Syria need a great host? I mean, this is a small city. Small, I'm sure small in comparison to many other, in comparison to Samaria. 25 acres. There could have been, I don't know this for any fact, but I'm just saying there could have been 2,000 people. It doesn't seem like 2,000 people fit in 25 acres, but if you do some calculations, some square footage, there could have been 2,000 people there. We don't know that. But archaeologists did find that the streets were very narrow, which leads me to believe that it was probably concentrated with housing in Samaria. I mean, in Dothan. And they also found this heavy wall. The city was fortified by a heavy wall. So anyhow, Dothan was a small city, and that is where Elisha dwelt. I believe that could also be where where Naaman came. He went to the king first, and the king said, oh, I can't help you out. If you remember that story, he went to Samaria, and then he sent him to find Elisha. Now, it also tells us in that story that there was a tower. So I don't know how much of a tower, and if it was actually a tower, what kind of a tower, but there may have been, Elisha's dwelling may have been, this is me assuming, but I'm assuming that he could have dwelt on the knob part rather than on the slope part of the city. We don't know that. So looking at verses 15 and 16. So when the servant got up early in the morning, and he had gone forth, maybe he stepped out of the room, stepped out of the house where he could look out around, and the city was compassed by this great host that we saw in verse 14. Both with horses and chariots. I don't know if the king of Syria thought, you know, this time, you know, Elisha's been telling secrets, but he certainly can't stand up to a whole host of horses and chariots. I don't know, if it says a great host, we don't know, but it could have been several hundred. When you think they were surrounding a perimeter of probably 4,000 feet, there could have been several hundred horses and chariots. Again, we don't know. But I'm thinking that the king of Syria probably thought he could just overwhelm the God of Elisha in this one. But verse 15, this puts some fear in the servant of the man of God. He said, alas, master, that's an expression of helplessness. Master, what are we going to do? How shall we do, he said then, after he exclaimed and was almost sorrowful with this. And he says, now what are we going to do? How can we get out of this? And Elisha just said, fear not, because those that be with us are more than what be with them. And then verse 17, Elisha prayed, and the Lord opened the eyes of this servant of the man of God, his servant. And he saw the hills surrounding and these horses and chariots of fire that were with them, that were their number. Moving on to verse 18, Elisha prayed, and these men were smitten with blindness. Now, we don't know for sure, but again, I'm using some assumption that they probably were not smitten with what we would call blindness where it was black. Likely not. You think about, I know God could have performed a variety of miracles one after the other. I know that he is capable to doing that. But a bunch of Bible scholars believe that it was just a distorted vision. They either, their vision was messed up to the point where what they saw was not what actually was there. Could have just been that they had really blurred vision and could not see. But there was a blindness of some sort. Maybe it was all black. But when you think about them, about Elisha leading them to Samaria, it would have taken quite a miracle to get this whole great host to Samaria if they were all completely blind. Not impossible, but it seems unlikely. Well, they were whatever type of blindness it was, they were unaware of what was before their eyes. They did not know that this was Elisha right before them. Now, verse 20, he says, "This is not the way, neither is this the city." I don't believe Elisha lied to them, because we know that the kings were warring back and forth. And we know that the goal of the king of Syria was to get the king of Israel. He was upset with Elisha. That's why he wanted to get Elisha out of the way and then go after the king of Israel, I'm sure. So Elisha led them. It says he led them to the capital of Israel, which was Samaria. And this was just about a 10 or 12 mile journey. This was not, again, just not across the brook. This was a 10 or 12 mile journey. Likely not a real flat walk. It was likely mountainous, hilly terrain that they had to go as they headed south to the city of Samaria. When they got there, verse 20 tells us that Elisha prayed again. He said, "Lord, open their eyes that they might see what's going on here." He led them into Samaria. Their eyes were open, and they discovered they were trapped. And right then and there, wicked King Jehoram wanted to kill them. "Shall I smite them?" He almost seems like a child that was over-anxious. "My father, shall I smite them? Shall I smite them?" Asking this question twice. He wanted to get right on with this. And Elisha reasoned with him and said, "Well, that's not what you normally do with your captives. You normally spare them and try and use them." And he said, "Feed them and let them go." So verse 23, they headed back home. And it says, "So the band of Assyria no more came into the land of Israel." And then if you look at verse 24, it says that Ben-Hadad gathered his host and went and besieged Samaria. Again, Bible scholars believe that was probably a year between verses 23 and 24, till Syria came back to Samaria. All right, now I'd like to look. I'm going to consider this story because I see the most human being here, if you understand what I'm saying, to be the servant. We don't know who Elisha's servant was. We know it wasn't Gehazi because he was smitten with leprosy a few chapters prior, so we don't know who it was. We don't have a name for him. But I'd like to look at about five things out of these verses, five instances from the servant's perspective. The fact here is that there was a real army of Syrians that were surrounding this small city. Again, we're in the servant's perspective. And these men, this army, this great host, was not here until they had fulfilled the orders of the king, and that was to take Elisha. They were here to get Elisha. "Alas, master, how shall we do? Can you understand why the servant..." We know the end of the story. The servant did not know the end of the story. Elisha likely did. The servant did not. The facts are that there's a real army. There's real danger here. And there is a reason, humanly speaking, to have fear. Number one, we'll look at verses 16 and 17 again. But number one, God is at work with his plan even before the question. So the servant asked that question, "Alas, master, how shall we do?" But God was already at work. God had already stepped in. God had already got involved. The army has surrounded us. Bring it to our own experience. The army has surrounded us. There's real things. There's real reason to be uncertain and have fear. And now we do see the heavenly host. The servant's eyes were open. He could see the heavenly host. But what do we as human beings do? Yeah, but they're out there in the hills. This army is right around this city. What good is the army? What good is all those that be with us today, all the heavenly bodies? What can they do for me when the horses and chariots are right here? They're right around the city. How can we escape them? I don't want to make this servant to be too human, but I'm just telling you how I deal with things sometimes. They certainly don't feel close enough to help me right now. They're out there. Yes, I know How shall we do? The moments are tense. Something bad is about to happen. The armies are right around us. We won't possibly pull through this time. Well, those thoughts and similar thoughts are the heart that's caving to human fear. There are for real dangers. Sometimes in our experiences, there are for real dangers. But the prophet calmly says, look, see, there are way more with us than would be with them. And Jesus says, just come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest. I'd like you to turn over to, if you can keep your finger in there, 2 Kings. We'll turn over to 1 Peter 5. As you think about the real fears, sometimes fears are not real. They're not founded on something for real, but in this case they were. What about us? 1 Peter 5, 5 to 7. Likewise, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder. Yea, all of you be subject one to another and be clothed with humility, for God resisteth the proud and giveth grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. Casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. And you may have wondered, why are we reading verse 5? Well, it follows the same. If it kind of introduces the thought, what does submitting younger to the elder have to do with casting all your care upon him? Why are pride, humility, and care all in the same sentence? Verses 6 and 7 are all the same sentence. Why is it that pride, humility, and care are all tucked in here? God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace to the humble. I don't have this figured out, but I do have this theory, and I'm going to leave it as a question. Could it be that fears are more likely to come from a proud heart than from an humble heart? He says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you. God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace to the humble. Now, humble yourselves, therefore, and then casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. All fears seem real to us, but not all of them are real. This one thing I do know. I know I raised the question, if it's an act of pride, if fears come from a heart of a proud heart rather than from an humble heart. I'm not saying an humble heart never has fears, but I think this one thing I do know, and that is that the proud heart cannot cast his cares on Jesus. Only the humble heart can actually cast his cares on Jesus and then let the cares there. The humble heart is a surrendered heart, if you remember from last Sunday. It's that heart that has surrendered itself to Jesus Christ. That's the only way we can have the humble heart. And the only way we can let go of a care is if we are no longer a big person and we just let the Heavenly Father, let Jesus Christ carry it for us. So God already knows what to do and what he will do in all of our fearful situations, whether for real or not for real. He just asks us to wait and watch his plan unfold. And that many times, I believe, is probably, not all, that's why I say many times, is the hardest part of that is the waiting. The waiting for God's plan to unfold. Even though the servant saw all those hosts, the heavenly hosts, he still didn't know what was going to happen. He still didn't know how it was going to pan out. Number two, God shows the next step in his time. And many times it's only one step. The pathway is obscure. The pathway is hidden. Where we have to go is hidden. These are kind of tied together. But he reveals the next step in his time. Verse 18. The next step was when Elisha prayed and said, Lord, smite these people with blindness. Make them blind. That was the next step. That's when I would, as the fearful servant, would say, oh, this is how it's working out. Okay, now these men can't determine what's going on. And when that step must be taken, when the step is shown in our experience by the Heavenly Father, we must take it without looking back. the man and woman of faith take the step when it's revealed. And we need to move off the spot at the direction of providence. In order to be in the will and blessing of the Heavenly Father, we cannot stay. We must take the step when prompted. The servant had to, I don't know what his part was, but he had to move forward when this step was taken. Does that step always bring the blessing we seek? When God gives us direction, does it always bring the blessing we seek? Do we find a blessing in every step we take? I would say not always. You know, Job prayed for his children that morning when they went to their brother's house and were feasting, and you know what? The house still blew down and killed them all. But, you know, Naaman got his life back when he finally took the small step of faith and went down and washed in the Jordan River. In all cases, God orders the life and the affairs of his own, and it will not always be smooth and pleasant, but it will always be for his honor and glory, and it will always fulfill his purposes, regardless of how it looks or feels to me. Number three, faith is needed for every step. Verse 19, then Elisha said to them, this is not the way, neither is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man you seek. And he led them to, it says, but he led them to Samaria. So I see two things here when I think about faith is needed for every step. Again, we're in the servant's perspective. If it was just Elisha and I walking down 10 or 12 miles to Samaria, and there was a great host following us, I would need faith to take the next step. They needed faith. I shouldn't say they. The servant, putting myself in the servant's shoes, I would need faith that I wouldn't be attacked on the way to, on the journey to Samaria. So what if their vision is hindered? They still might attack us. We might not make it to Samaria. I would also would have needed faith that God would keep their vision impaired. So what happens? We're 4 miles into this journey, and all of a sudden their vision comes back, and they see, oh, here's the man we want, so we're going to take him and his servant both. Faith is needed every step. James 1, verses 6 and 7. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, for he that wavereth is like the wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. When the man of faith cries out to God, he doesn't waver. That's what I see here in James. I believe there can be seasons of weakness, but if there's doubt, I see here in verse 7, the man that wavers is like the wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. He's all around and says, don't let that man think he's going to receive anything from the Lord. If I'm going to waver around in my faith, and my faith wavers, do not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Don't expect results if we're not going to ask in faith. And there again, I go back to the verses in Peter. I'm not going to ask in faith if I'm a proud man. I can only ask in faith if I have the heart of humility. Luke 18 tells us about the widow that kept requesting things from the unjust judge. She kept requesting him to avenge her adversary. And in the end, the judge finally did so, but he said it was only because she kept nagging at him, in my own words. She kept requesting it, kept coming back. And then Jesus says that our Heavenly Father will avenge his own if we cry to him. He says it right there in those verses. And then he closes with the question, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? And I believe that openly requesting help from our Heavenly Father is a display of faith. He sees that as faith and confidence in him. Faith is needed every step of the way. Number four, verse 21. Justice, according to our terms, is not served. And maybe this one is not as closely related, but again, I'm the servant. And sure, why wouldn't the king of Israel just take care of these people? These people are seeking his life. Why wouldn't he just deal with them? But justice was not served according to my terms. It will not be. Humanly speaking, justice and fairness was not accomplished. It would have been right for the king to kill these Syrian warriors. They had been a problem for Israel for years already. I don't think this was the whole army. It was just it wasn't the whole Syrian army, but it was a group of them. When we, with an open heart and mind, ask the question, how shall we do? Self-concern and interest dare not be in the way, or it will get in the way. And many times, God's plan doesn't take the road that makes the most sense. It's not the makes good sense road, because he has a higher plan, a different plan than what we think he should have. Number five, rest and closure came at the timing of the Almighty. There in verse 23, it says, and they went to their masters, so the bands of Syria came no more into the land of Israel. So they had rest, but it was only according to God's terms. It was only the way it was only when he chose it to happen. They had rest for a little while. But you know what? Again, in the eyes of the servant, his thoughts may have been, so when will this enemy strike again? And if his thoughts had been, so when will the enemy strike again? We're going to keep this fear thing going. This enemy's bound to strike again. There would not have been rest with God's provision had they continued to think that way. Now, I don't think they ventured into the land of Syria. I mean, I don't think they put themselves in direct danger. But I also don't think that they laid awake at night waiting for the army to surround Dothan again. So for myself, for us this morning, when we've given things over to God, if we take them up again rather than allow him to carry them, we've just told God that he's inadequate and he's not able to carry us. He's not able to carry our cares. I had to think of this song by Mosey Lister, I think it was a writer, back in the 50s or 60s, he wrote it. Familiar song to us. My Jesus knows just what I need. You know, we sing that song sometimes. But living it and believing it, living it and having it touch and change our hearts is yet a different thing. But should the surges rise and rest delay to come, blessed be the tempest, kind the storm which drives us near her home. We sang that. Soon shall our doubts and fears all yield to thy control. Thy tender mercies shall illume the midnight of the soul. I believe those words to be true. When the midnight of our soul has come over us, his tender mercies are waiting to illume our soul. But God resisteth the proud and giveth grace to the humble. So let's, in humility, reach out and allow him to lead us. Let's kneel together for prayer.